You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
My name is Richard Bush. I'm the director of the Center for Northeast Asian Policy Studies here at Brookings. And it's our pleasure to join with our colleagues in the John L. Thornton China Center to co-sponsor this outstanding program. The title of this session is Geopolitics and Competition for Soft Power in East Asia. We will have two presentations. First of all, by Huang Minhua, who is affiliated with Shanghai Jiaotong University, and then by Bridget Welch, who is an associate professor at Singapore Management University. And while the presentations are going on, I ask the panelists to stay seated on the first row. Then we'll migrate up here, and Andy Nathan and Mike Lampton will provide some commentary, and then we will open it up for what I hope is a decent amount of time for Q&A. So, Professor Huang.
Thanks, Richard. And thanks you all to attend this conference. Before I start, I want to talk a little bit about my working experiences, because I got a PhD from Michigan, and I worked in Taiwan for 4 years, two different schools, and I moved to Texas A&M for another 4 years, and this year back to China. So I have been working in four different universities, in three places, Taiwan, China, U.S. So I kind of have feelings about the issues that we are talking about this. But I'm poisoned too much by the so-called political science training. So this kind of piece is a little bit more technical, but I try to make it more accessible. I'm going to talk about a little bit of my take about, the layout, this presentation. The first is China. By many aspects, military, economic, political, and culture, no doubt now is a rising powers. And also Chinese leaders, the bulk of the leaders, they all know they are rising powers. They know their power is rising. And in fact, they are try very hard to keep, this my understanding, keep low profile. You can see the Hu Jintao, Wen Jiabao, Xi Jinping, Li Keqiang, all these top leaders, they are talking in prudence in a way. But of course, they initiate a lot of official campaigns for public diplomacy and also image construction around the world. So there are a lot of measures that Professor Chu has already mentioned for the last 8 years. But how about the those neighboring countries in Asia when they look at the China's this kind of rising powers and as well as their political leaders trying to do? How they feel about this? Unfortunately, there are a lot of events, particularly security-related, kind of tended or kind of countervail China's efforts. For example, like Japan recently, you see the Diaoyutai Island dispute. You see inside of Japan, their political campaign actually quite very, very against China, particularly for the LDP government when it goes up. And you see Taiwan is kind of ambivalent because economically you cannot deny that Taiwan and China, they should go together. And politically you see the KMT has a very nice relationship with China, but in fact politically KMT met a lot of troubles. So it could swing to the other way when the economic bonus gone away in a few years. In Korea, you see the North Korea issues. It's kind of worsening. And as well as the U.S. presence in Korea Peninsula kind of making, China, of course, now seems to following the existing norm, but it's no guarantee, right? And you see Philippines and Vietnam, island dispute in South China Sea, and particularly recently in China, there is a voice out in some very, very, scholars saying that China probably should stand tough, so they are kind of making establish the administrative unit in Sansa City, and they kind of secure the regular presence in the South China Sea. And you see Mongolia, there is a long-standing aversion in Mongolian politics that really, really dislike China because they are totally dependent on China, economically speaking. So all these factors, in a way, that kind of making China's public diplomacy and image construction efforts counterproductive or not have any effect at all. So this paper actually is more about a collective effort to identify the explanatory sources of how Asian perceptions of China's rise, whether it's positive or negative. We want to look at the country level. I mean, country level, there are a lot of issues Professor Zhu has already talked about. So it's a kind of follow-up study here, like geopolitics issues, like economic interdependence, like cultural affinity or distance. But when we do the public opinion survey, mostly the measurement will be at the individual level because we interview, we use the stratified random sampling, and then we kind of have a probabilistic samples in representative scientifically of all the countries. So there are a lot of individual level factors that involve, for example, socioeconomic satisfaction, whether people, when they feel their socioeconomic situation better, because if you think about all the Asian countries, they all have very, very tight relationship in terms of economics. Export, import, they are part of the production chain in the Pacific Rims. So when their economic situation goes well, they properly would think about, okay, this related to China. So it could generate positive an evaluation about China. So that's individual level factors. It's not just that. It could like cognitive factors too. For example, if they think that China, democratic speaking, they think China at the same level of them, they probably would be have a nicer image of China, right? But if you feel that China is really, really undemocratic, abuse of human rights, and politically not democratic at all, they probably have a very bad feeling about China. And also, ideology. That ideology, what I mean, is about economic openness. Because in China, in Asia-Pacific, for example, let me give you a case like Taiwan, a lot of people debating about whether we should refrain ourselves in terms of economic integrations. Because if we integrate too much with China, we probably would get hurt. And in some countries, it's more like Mongolia. Even it's really benefit for Mongolian to bundle their interests with China. There are a lot of policy debate inside of Mongolia because they hate China. And if they feel they are economically totally tied with China, they lose all their independence. As well as political values, it's more deeper levels, like attitudinal, like in their values, deep down their heart, they don't like the Chinese-style traditionalist, authoritarian, these kind of factors. So it's individual-level factors. So when we do the public opinion survey, the country level, the contextual, the structural factors, as well as individual-level factors, both factors would have effects on the people's evaluation, right? So in terms of policy training, we try to find a way to tease out the particular factors, how much they actually exert their influence on perception of China, right? So I lay out the main purpose of this paper. So this is the first slide. We have two questions that we try to measure the perception of China. The first, which is which country has the most influence in China? Then you see China, Japan, India. Most influence in Asia, still you see the answer set is China, Japan, India, United States, and others, right? And then we definitely want to see if it's China or not China. So that's the major one. Major two is regardless whether respondents think China has influences, whether they think China do good more than harm, all right? So those two, I would take individual is either yes or no. It become a binary. And then we will take the percentage of positive responses of both variable, and then we can spot each country's location because it become a percentage measure, right? So it jointly plots into a two-dimensional figures, then you can see there's a four areas, right? Generally, if you look at the bottom right, you see if they have, they think China has the most influence, and it's the percentage is very high. But you see, they have very negative perception of China. If that is the case, then it shows that the general public in this country, they they vigilant China's rights, but they have widespread dislike about China, right? If you see the upper left, then you see if they don't think that China has the most influence in Asia, mostly if they don't think, but if they have a much nicer, positive, or favorable perception of China, then you see they are less vigilant about China's rights, but they hold much more benign attitude toward China's influences, right? So if you see the top right corners here, it means that they have great vigilance, but it's not actually that sure whether China's influence is actually goes which way. So then I will show you the empirical data, then you will see why I categorize or I label this way. And then you see the left corner, left bottom corner, which is ignoring China, because China is not, you know, have influences, not most influence, and they don't really like China. So there's about like just a conceptual drill in your before we look at the data. And then this is what data looks like, all right? So we see in the bottom right corner, we see there are two countries, which is Japan and Mongolia. You show very, very high vigilance about the China's influence in Asia, but you see very low, I mean, favorable perception about China. So you see the margin is really, really revealing, right? So which means that they have great vigilance about China, but they don't like China at all. And you see the other set, which is comprising three countries, Korea, Taiwan, and Vietnam. They are all about similar levels, but it's all about like 50% or even 60%. They are vigilant, well vigilant about the rise of China, but they sort of have a slightly more positive attitude toward China, but not that quite. It's not like 80, 90, 100%. So it's about the same level, which means they're kind of ambivalent about mixed feeling about how to interpret the rise of China. They all know China is rising, but they just kind of struggling in their mind, well, geez, how should I think of it? And you see the button, all these countries, the rest of the other countries, including China itself, you see mostly they have favorable or benign, you know, perception of China, but they are not really think that China has the most influence in Asia. Okay, so that's what I call less vigilance, but more benign attitudes. So that's about our finding. If we look at these two items together, then we can get a picture like that. Then what we're trying to do actually is follow up Professor Zhu's presentation in the last panels that we look at, for example, geopolitical tensions. Here, of course, I'm poisoned by poli-sci training. So I give a definition here. It's defined as a composite indicator comprising. The first is non-ASEAN plus one. ASEAN plus one is ASEAN country plus China. And then warring experience, whether they have the warring experience in the last century. And then there's a regime similarity. Regime similarity is quite easy. I just use polity for using seven as the, they have polity score, which is the difference between democratic score and autocratic score. If higher than seven, I define it as a democracy. So it's simply just whether China is not democracy, whether all the rest of the other countries, they are democracy or not. If they are democracy, they are different from China. So it's one. If they are not democracy, by polity definition, then they are the same, right? So here basically is what I call geopolitical tension. Here's just one tiny thing I wanted to elaborate a little bit about the non-ASEAN plus one. It's not actually saying that the ASEAN, a lot of people knowing, is mostly about free trade. About the security, it's not really that tight, and they are not have a very, very a strong kind of enforcement agreement between them that they should how to defense coordinate together. But it's kind of, think about this. China, as opposed to like Korea, Japan, Taiwan, Mongolia, all these countries, China has a separate issue with all these places. And all these places, although all have relationship with the United States, and kind of kind of balancing out what China's trying to, in terms of conflict of interests. It's different from ASEAN, because ASEAN kind of have more multilateral mechanism that they can coordinate the interests. And so China, my understanding is China trying to stay away to have a really serious conflict against ASEAN. They try to be nicer, very nice, give them a lot of investment, buying their economy and trying to shape good images in Southeast Asia. Although it might run the other way, but it's my understanding, China trying to do this, trying to please the ASEAN countries. So that's the reason when I say it's non-ASEAN, then you will see much more likely they have certain kind of tension because they all have deep issues with China. And an ASEAN country, China trying at this stage, in my understanding, trying to please the ASEAN countries. So what this actually says, we have a geopolitical tension measures like this. And then if we plot all these countries in these two-dimensional dependent variable, and inside the parenthesis, there is a measure of geopolitical tensions. Then you mostly will see this is just a hypothetical line. You don't have to make a 60% like this, the dotted line. But I'm just trying to give you a sense that if you look at this, the lower right corners, which I think they are very vigilant and they are dislike China, then you will see mostly Taiwan, Korea, Vietnam, Mongolia, Japan, they all cluster the border or inside the corners. So which means geopolitical tension actually is related to why they don't like China or why they are really vigilant about China's rise. So that's just some kind of a rough empirical finding I'm just showing you about the geopolitical factors. The other is the economic interdependence. Professor Zhu's paper also pointed out it's really difficult for us to think about how economic interdependence will affect how people think about China, right? So here I'm trying to do something. Economic interdependence, I define, again, it's a poison by policy, defined as the average percentage of bilateral export and import with China in proportion to overall export and import volume, respectively. So it's just taking average of the 2%. I'm not calculating the net amount of like a deficit or I'm not doing that. I just to measure the interdependence. Maybe it's not perfect, but it's a way of measurement. So you see the measure here. And generally, this tells you if they are interdependent with China more, and they will have less favorable perception of China. But here you see it could be an outlier like Japan or Mongolia making this negative. But if you're taking off those two cases, it still looks like negative. It's just more clustered together, but it's still negative. So this negative relationship stands out. And it's kind of countervail to our knowledge so far that we think economic interdependence will bring about the interests together and then kind of resolve the conflicts between the countries in Asia, particularly with China. It seems not the case. Then we have cultural distance. The other factors we should not really forget is about cultures. Again, poison by policy. Defined as the level of cultural differences in view of Chinese traditional social value, including the following dimension. In Asian Barometer, we have 14 questions measuring so-called traditional value, which all anchors on some kind of Chinese cultural elements, like collectivism versus individualism, like long-term prospect of interest versus self-interest, like collective interest versus self-interest, filial piety, respect for authority, conflict avoidance, fatalism, gender bias. There are 14 questions that you can measure that. And you see, we use the China's measure as the cardinal points, and then we measure the distance. So take the absolute value of the differences. Then you see this is the cultural differences measure here. All right, then just I plot with the, I only find it's significantly related to China has the most influence, which is the recognition question. So here it's basically telling you, if they have a more cultural difference, generally they were less likely to recognize that China's influences. If they are culturally more close to China, then you will understand and you are more likely to feel that China actually, its power is rising, its influence is rising. All right? So that's the basic finding here. This table, again, is poisoned by poli-sci. But what it actually do is that since we have pointed out contextual factors matters, individual factor matters, all these matter. How can we do that? So we actually can do the so-called multi-level analysis. Here I actually doing what we call contextual modeling, which I include the individual level factors as well as the contextual level factors put into the same model. I normalize all the variable before I do the analysis. So their scale are all the same. It's a standard normal distribution. Then the meaning is that the coefficient, the magnitude of the coefficient, we can actually compare and to tell whether it's more powerful or less powerful. That's what I basically do. And here, no significant, then I just skip it. And then you see there's a shaded pink area telling you what's significant, explaining these two. The first is the China, whether they acknowledge China's rise, they think China has the most influence. The other is whether they have favorable image of China, right? But basically, you can see the first model, none of the contextual variable matters, all right? And it matters in what? In the liberal orientation, in education, in male. It's most likely like American textbook about the political interests. People, if they are more interested, if they have higher education, if they are male, they are more interested in politics. And because of that, they know more about what China's power is in the region and as well as the world. So the non-finding of the first model actually has more revealing and meanings, which means that actually, so far, China's efforts in public diplomacy is not actually biased upward or biased downward about people's perception about whether China has rise or not. It's still like American textbook, American politics textbook telling you if people are more interested, they will select themselves to know about China, and then they will know China is rising because that's a fact. But I would see most interesting is in the second model. You see, although there are some kind of significance in the individual level, comparing to the magnitude here, the most significant factors is all contextuals. Although individual level factor also matters, and you see there's a negative about the liberal orientation as well as the favorable image. There's definitely, if you have more liberal orientation, you definitely dislike China, and you have negative evaluation of China's image. So it's nothing surprise. But it jumps up as the contextual factor here really matters. And you see the economic interdependence here, showing the negative relationship, which means if the countries, if they are economically interdependent with China more, generally in that context, in that countries, people would generally have a more negative, view or perception about China. All right, so it's about the general findings here. I want to make some I want to use 2 minutes very quickly talk about something. All this fighting basically telling you that in terms of whether they recognize China's rise or not, it's not so much about political or economic related. It's not about the context. It's about the political knowledge, interest in politics, psychological involvement in politics. So again, like I say, it could mean that lack of significant effects of China's public diplomacy. Because China trying to do public diplomacy, if people realize it, they should be more aware about China's rise, right? But people mostly in Asia, they don't know about this. But it could be optimistic interpretation about the first model, the non-fighting model, which is that it shows no sign of political antagonism that relates to anxiety or fear about China's rise, right? If you have anxious about China's right, if you have a political fear about China's right, then you will be more vigilant, right? But I didn't see that. So it's just like American textbook, theory about interest in politics and knowing whether China is the rise or not. But the second interpretation here is about the second model. Here, basically telling you the geopolitical tension as well as the cultural difference, those two factors, you cannot actually change it in a very short period of time. So not much can do. The Chinese leader, they don't have, they cannot actually change that much in a short period of time. What they can do actually is economic interdependence. But the bad news here is that if economic interdependence, China with their neighboring country, you see even more negative perception about China. They're telling very bad news, right? Because China think that if they bundle their economic interests with all their neighbor, become part of the production chain, they can buy all these countries in their favor. No. But here I wanted to give you a qualification. If you take away, okay, if you take away Mongolia, then the relationship was significantly reduced. So that's a qualification I wanted to remind you. Okay, I stop here. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. I'm going to see if I can get these things going here. I'd like to, first of all, thank Jonathan Pollack and Richard Bush for the kind invitation here at Brookings. And I'd also like to acknowledge some old friends in the audience and new friends, and to wish everybody a happy Easter for those who are celebrating Easter. My job is to present one specific question that has not been presented so far, which is looking at the issue of which model should East Asian publics follow. And in this question, I'm looking, basically assessing which choices they make in terms of which country they should follow and why. I want to begin, because time is short, with some of the key takeaways of the presentation, and then go into some of the assessments. Essentially, this question is used as a measure of what are the levels of soft power, and I'll show you what those answers are. And I also look at what are the factors and actors that account for these particular variations. And here's what I found. First of all, U.S. soft power is actually much higher than China. U.S. is chosen as a model much more among East Asian publics than China, across countries in terms of measure, and also across the region as a whole. So when we look at the earlier discussions, was looked at questions of influence or perceptions. Actually, when they're forced to ask which country they would follow, the U.S. comes out in a much more positive light than China does. The second big takeaway is that there's considerable variation among East Asia. There are some countries that are more likely to choose China than the United States, and there are differences in the degree of which they will choose U.S. over China or even over other answers. And this variation is very interesting, and that raises the questions of the puzzles. And in a sense, what I try to do is to try to explain this variation. What are the reasons for that? And I use two different levels of analysis. I look specifically at factors that are at the country level, things like security, economic interdependence, cultural affinity, things that were just recently presented by my colleague Yimin Hua. And the second thing I look at are actually individual level analyses. And here we're very lucky in the Asia Barometer Survey and that we have 200 other questions that we can use to actually assess what are the reasons that they may have these different perspectives. And we actually come up with very interesting findings in that actually, no surprise, values do matter. And democratic values and Asian values and even perceptions about questions associated with demographic features, these also come into play. And what we see here is that of the factors that emerge that are important in understanding why people in East Asia choose between China or between the United States, we see a few key things, and here they are. Security clashes matter. Hard power affects soft power. The second thing that actually is interesting is that governments and countries that promote China as a model or promote the United States as a model, actually this impacts the way public perceive it. The third thing that we find is that particularly values towards democracy or towards Asian values like traditional political traditionalism, these impact people's perceptions at the individual level. And importantly, if they think China is actually nice, positive, actually, they think China should be a model. So, in fact, most of the things, that's the key thing, excuse me, that pulls support towards China. So, in this regard, what's very interesting are some of the implications. Bob Sutter, just a moment ago, in the earlier panel, emphasized, thank you very much, I hope it's not some sort of East Asia flu that I've got on the plane. is that what China does actually affects, if China's nice, it's going to affect its public perception. The implication in looking at this particular set of questions and analysis only reinforces that, and in particular in the area of security. The second issue is that the implication here is the U.S. The U.S.'s power is quite important in the soft power, and that its base of its soft power rests heavily with its democratic orientation. And this is actually a very important pull factor for many of the countries in East Asia. So here are those key takeaways. And now let me try to use the next 12 minutes or so to actually explain these. So here's just a bit of an overview that basically we don't really have very good measures of what soft power perceptions are. And what the ABS survey does is that it actually really is quite innovative in that it offers us what we can see from below in a very innovative way. And it allows us to look at questions like the variation in perceptions among publics, how it relates to questions of soft power, and also it allows us to make assessments between U.S. and China. And I agree wholeheartedly with what Satu said earlier, that we frame this as a competition. But in fact, the reality is most people in the region don't see it that way. But I think for the purpose of a heuristic device, we're going to present it that way. And the survey, as you've learned earlier, it comes from recent data in 13 countries and territories. We really only present 12 because Hong Kong's not in the analysis here. But we do generally actually see very interesting differences. And I want to also plug, like Yunhan did before, we'd like to expand into Myanmar, and so we need money for that. So if you have money for that, I'd be particularly very happy for that. The question we used in this analysis is which country would you choose as a model? And the options they had were China, the United States, India, Japan, and, of course, yourself. And here we go. We look at this at the rubrics of different security country-level analysis and individual-level analysis. Here are the findings. Let me draw your attention to the thing you can't see, which is underneath the table, and that is the issues associated with the average numbers. The United States, 28% of East Asian publics on average choose the U.S. as a model. As compared to China, 13%, less than half that of the United States. And if we look at the overall answers and responses to this question, China comes fourth. I know four is not a good lucky number in the China context. But what we're looking at is, if we see this, in terms of who East Asia's in the region see, they choose first the United States, and then followed by themselves, and then Japan, and then China. And also for those of you who look at these issues of questions in the regard to India, I would only point out that India got a very pathetic number of 1%. So what we're looking at is in the larger scheme of things, we're actually seeing a very dominant choice of the United States as a leader to choose to follow. And I think this is very telling for the larger perspectives and assessments, because unlike the other questions which ask about influence or perceptions, this is a question that really actually, I think in some way, shows the attraction of different models and, in a sense, is a much better measure of soft power than some of the other areas which just measure powers and perceptions. But what this doesn't capture, and as I'm sure you're already looking at these numbers, and it's a, you know, waking up, you're a post-coffee wake-up type of situation, you're seeing lots of variation. I think I wanted to draw your attention to specifically the U.S.-China variation in this answer. And the way I organized the data is I actually went from the lowest to highest. And so let me just pull out a few of the findings here. The first key finding I want to mention is that the yellow number is actually, the yellow stream is much higher than the brown stream, aka U.S. versus China, in the overwhelming majority of countries. So the majority of countries in East Asia are more likely to choose the United States as a model than China. And it's really very acute in places like the Philippines, where the Philippines, it's about 70% versus 7%. So we can see in the Philippines, there's a clear position that is very marked. And then we see similar high numbers in the context of Korea, in context of Cambodia. More than double of Cambodians or Koreans are more likely to choose the United States as a model to follow than that of China. But then towards the other end of this, where we start to look at the lower numbers, this is where the complexities start to come in. And this, I think, only reinforces what Sato was saying in the presentation earlier, is people don't like to be forced to have to make these types of choices. And we actually see a lot of diversity. So we actually see a number of countries where the China is actually much higher than that of the United States. The most prominent of that, of course, is Vietnam. Interestingly enough, Vietnam has tensions with China. There's lots of issues. But in fact, more than double Vietnamese are more likely to choose China as a model than the United States. Obviously, there was lots of tensions with the United States as well. But we also have the questions also in the case of Malaysia, in the case of Thailand. These are the countries where China actually has more of a model impact in sense of choice of a model than the United States. But the other countries are towards in the middle, and we still see the general trend. I would also like to point out another country that has very big difference in terms of choosing the United States versus China is Japan, 2% versus almost 20%. Again, a very important, sharp dichotomy. Although many, as you go back to the slide earlier, many Japanese choose themselves. Japan is the highest country that over half of Japanese, 52% of Japanese, choose their own country as a model, which I find also quite an interesting type of finding. All right. So these are some of the broader implications of what we're seeing. First of all, the Southeast Asian numbers generally are higher than the Northeast Asian numbers, which I think is quite revealing. And again, this goes back to what Yun Han was pointing out, geography, place, position, or so to say, the further away from you are from China, the more likely you're likely to choose China. Another way of phrasing that. The majority, as I've said, majority of countries. And I think another interesting observation is that China itself chooses the U.S. model more than its own model. 38% of Chinese as opposed to 27% of Chinese. And I think this is also very revealing and would be a wake-up call if I was China. Okay, some of the other observations I've made. Now, so given all this variation, how do we begin to understand it in a way that actually makes sense? So I essentially used basically four levels of analysis, four different issues in the country-level analysis. I looked at security tensions. I looked at alliance relationships. I looked at economic interdependence, a.k.a. trade, aid flows, budget deficits, economic investment. I looked at whether or not the governments promoted different models, and I looked at the questions of cultural affinity and clashes. And here, out of these four questions, the two factors that emerge as actually important are security tensions and model promotion. In fact, in contrast a little bit to what was presented by Min Hua, cultural affinity doesn't seem to impact this particular question. And interestingly enough, and I think this is very important from a policy perspective, economic interdependence doesn't seem to be a factor either. Right? What really matters are security and the actions of elites in these countries in promoting different models for development. And let me just pull out a few of those, because obviously I'm short of time, and I've promised Jonathan. Jonathan sits next to me, so I've been given that nudge I better keep to time. And that is that the security tension issues clearly comes out, especially in Northeast Asia. But if you look at the numbers that Japan, Taiwan, Korea, and the Philippines have about choosing China as a model, we actually see these are countries disproportionately that have poor security relations. And in contrast, the security alliances, such as the affinity between the United States and Thailand, United States and Korea, they're not as much of a pull factor as clearly the tensions issue that matter. Now, the only exception has to do with Vietnam. And I think part of that can be explained by the second explanation at the country level, which has to do with the promotion of a different of China as a model among Vietnamese. And I think that explains some of that reasons. Values are also come into play. I've already gotten the 2-minute mark, so I'm actually going to speed up a tiny bit. All right. Then we look at the micro level. And here is we use this huge set of questions that we have. And we look at attitudes towards equality, attitudes towards freedom, support for authoritarianism, authoritarian should have an ism, Asian values, social and political traditionalism, demographic features, and views of China's position. And we see which of these factors help us to understand why they might have chosen the United States versus why they might have chosen China. And here are some of the findings that we find at the micro level. If you like equality, you choose the United States. If you like freedom, you choose the United States. If you are less politically traditional, you choose the United States. And if you have more money, you choose the United States. The United States is more of a pull factor at these individual levels. The only thing that pulled China towards China was that they saw your view as positive in the region. That was the only thing that really pulled you in that particular area. So political culture and values really mattered in the context at the local level and the individual level for supporting the United States and not choosing China. But in fact, choosing China, it really had to do with the actions that the China, how they perceived what China was doing. So this brings me to the conclusion of my presentation, and that is, soft power for the United States remains quite significant, that the push factors for China are actually very significant. And this goes back, reinforces what Bob Sutter said earlier, if China acts and is nice, then people will think of it as nice and think of it as a model. If it chooses not to be nice, well, enough said. The pull factors for democracy in terms of soft power for the United States, rising democracy, more prosperity, is going to likely increase the United States' soft power. And so from a perspective of policy, this actually suggests that the United States really needs to stick with what it knows best, which is working on its economy, promoting democracy, acting democratic, and this will maintain its soft power. I think the trend suggests that China needs to be more careful of its actions, especially in Southeast Asia. I'll close there. Thank you so much.
If the presenters and the panelists, commentators could come up to the stage. Bridget, while you're getting your stuff, I would speculate that maybe the reason that the Vietnamese prefer the Chinese model best is that they believe that that's the best way to deal with the security challenge that China poses, that they would be less able to do so if they had an American model because it's too chaotic. So, we turn the floor over first to Andy Nathan, and then Mike Lampton for about 10 minutes worth of comments. So, Andy,
I wonder if Minhua, if we could see Minhua's slide, the multi-level analysis. I just want to clarify something.
Could we bring the screen down again, please?
Sorry,
it's okay.
Yeah. Is that right? Thanks. So all these data are going by us very fast, so I just want to check in with Minhua here. The two dependent variables, China's rise and favorable image, how are they measured? China's rise, I believe, was a question introduced in Yunhan's paper. Most influence in Asia. And the favorable image question? Is China's impact on the region largely positive or negative? Okay, good. So I want to suggest one way of thinking about these two papers is in the context of studies about what drives public opinion. And as you've heard mentioned, there's a long tradition of work in this area, particularly in the area of American politics. And you've heard mentioned this book by Page and Xie called Living with the Dragon, but Page is chiefly a student of American politics and wrote an earlier book with Bob Shapiro, Page and Shapiro. The name of that book, as I recall, is The Rational Public. Is that the right name? And so there's a long series of investigations into public opinion about although public opinion fluctuates and there are many irrational people in the public, according to this stream of research, if you average out public opinion, as is done in these studies, there's a consistency and a realism in the development of public opinion. Public opinion simply responds eventually in a rather steady manner to realities on the ground, to the facts that exist, even though people's knowledge of those facts, as you've heard, is partly selective. That is, if you're educated, if you're interested, you will learn more, and so there's that variation, as well as that the public's access to the facts is mediated through the media, which may have their own biases and mechanisms. Nonetheless, there is this argument that in the bottom line, in the big picture, the public sees the truth, the facts, and its opinions evolve in that way. A second view of public opinion is to say that it is controlled by stereotypes and prejudices, by, say, images of China as, you know, a different, say, in the American case, you know, as exotic, as foreign, as yellow, you know, things like that, the yellow horde. And in the case of Asia, by images of China that wouldn't respond to changing situations. They're just stereotypes and prejudices. And a third view of public opinion is that it can be manipulated by public relations activities, by propaganda. And I'm sure that there's some truth in all of these views, but what I got out of these two papers on this panel was an argument from the paper writers, and it seemed to me to be a pretty strong one, in support of this view that public opinion is actually shaped by real interests and real behaviors. And so if we're looking still at and Bridget's and Minhua's presentations are very consistent, although they deal with different dependent variables. So his dependent variables were these two questions that we just reviewed, where her main dependent variable is this question of what country would you take as a model. And you can imagine that an intelligent respondent to the questionnaire might respond in different ways to these questions. So, for example, Thailand, what country would you take as a model, having been through the corruption and the coups and the struggle between the countryside and the city and all that? Maybe the Thais wouldn't want to be like the United States with our similar crazy stuff going on here with the red states and the blue states, and maybe, you know. So it depends. The dependent variables are different. But I think both Bridget's and Minhua's findings show a realism of public opinion. Individual level effects, democratic, just to look at this particular table, and Bridget also emphasized this a lot. I mean, if you like democracy and liberalism, then it makes sense to, you know, look at China with some alarm and so on. And on the contextual effects, I gather that Bridget and Minhua operationalized geopolitical tension differently, because Bridget gave a higher score for Vietnam's and Philippines' political tension than Minhua did, and I would say Bridget's measurement was more correct than Minhua's. But, but you know, it doesn't matter too much in a way, because if Minhua were to change his coding to coincide with Bridget's, it would make that particular figure that he presented only more striking. It would just move more, it would strengthen the degree to which the countries that have geopolitical tension are in the quadrant where they ought to be. So, you know, I think both of the papers suggest that these publics in Asia are looking at their interests. They're looking at their interests at an individual level and at a national level, and then they're judging China from that point of view. And that would bring me to a second point, which is that I was surprised. Bob Sutter really hit it when he said, you know, the message of these papers is that China should be nice. And I even wonder whether, in some sense, that was the purpose of the project. I don't know. And I'm certainly not accusing anybody of cooking the data. But you know, there's a strong message that if you think you can do soft, if you think you can increase your prestige just by talking nice and claiming to be benign, it won't work. But then how to be nice? And I think most of the presentations emphasize being nice to Asians, you know, to not be so assertive in the South China Sea and things like that. But a second thing that came out more to me, because as you know, I'm interested in human rights issues in China, is how important it is for China to change its domestic system and stop violating human rights if it wishes to be taken seriously as a benign country. And this raises a kind of puzzle about the United States, which is that in most regions of the world, the United States, and in Asia especially, I suppose, is accepted as a benign presence, even though if we think about history in a dispassionate way, its presence has not been very benign in Asia, at least in a lot of ways. Maybe it's been benign economically, but not in many other ways. How do you get to be perceived as benign? The domestic model is actually maybe very, very important in that respect. And this makes the challenge for China to be even greater. And since I'm appearing on the next panel, I have an opportunity to go into other aspects of these questions then.
Well, thank you to the organizers. Thank you to the paper writers. Also, I just want to commend the sort of cross-strait collaborative dimension of this. I think that's really a good thing, and commend all that have pushed in that direction. Also, I hope you find the money to expand the polling effort, so I'll throw my weight behind that, whatever that may be. I must say, the most interesting, disturbing number I've seen was actually in the last panel, revealing. And that was roughly 97% of Chinese think they're doing terrifically. I mean, it doesn't show a high paying attention to the data and the system responding to the environment in the way you would hope. Now, a little was taken off the edge by Bridget's observation that Chinese actually seem to, with at least a plurality, prefer the American model to their own. So that shows a certain self-analytic capability that the other figure doesn't. But I think it's a very interesting question. Why is China not paying more attention to its environment than this data suggests? Now, I disagree a little with Bob because he basically said China's never, since 1949, paid attention to its environment, and so that's not changing. I see what he means, and I don't entirely disagree. But the fact is, I think from what was notable from 1977 to 2008 was China really managed to dramatically increase its hard power without scaring the neighborhood to a dramatic degree. And then somewhere around 2008, 2009, suddenly it was like the memory bank on reassuring foreign policy got erased. So I think the really interesting analytic question is, why has Chinese foreign policy, to the degree the Chinese would deny it's changed, but in fact I think there's a wide degree of consensus that it has in some important ways, what accounts for that? Now, you know, I'm not going to defend the Chinese because I've already postulated what I think the basic problem is, and it lies substantially in that direction. But one thing that hasn't come up is the Southeast Asians, or for that matter, the Northeast Asians and Japan, as actors that shape China's behavior. We don't want to have the assumption that all the behavior of everybody around China has been entirely reassuring to China either. So there's an interactive process, and this sort of looks as the neighbors, as the inert receptors of Chinese behavior and so forth. I think that's clearly not, that's probably, in my view, not a sustainable model. Now, it seems to me these papers, I'll treat them the same, or I'll make some comments that suggest I see them in the same vein, but there are some differences that I would want to highlight, too. First of all, I think they really raise the right questions. I mean, how successful are China's soft power efforts? They're putting a lot of effort behind it, and I think the data here would suggest not achieving all that China would have hoped. Is China's soft power being, or its efforts in this regard, being more successful in some areas than others? And I think in relative terms, yes, they're more successful in Southeast Asia than Northeast Asia is certainly the case. What could China do to improve its efficacy? I think we have some answers there. I guess Bob has stolen our conceptual formulation. It's be nice. Is the answer to that question. But anyway, it seems to me these papers are both asking the right questions, and they come up, broadly speaking, with what strike me as the sensible answers. We can't go into it, but you have so many questions, and you put several questions and the answers together, and you sort of have measures that are reflect multiple questions. There's a lot of methodology, which I'm sure I mostly don't understand, going on behind. But you do end up with some results that lead me to think you got countries not exactly in what I would have thought was the right place. The Philippines just continually shows up in places in your charts where I wouldn't have predicted it. Maybe I'm wrong, but at least I need more convincing on that. Vietnam, too. Just seems to me that the perception of hostility I get when I go and interview in Vietnam is a lot higher than what I would call ambivalence. Vietnam, it seems to me. Also, I would just note American allies don't always come up very high in their appreciation of the United States. We have to go. And I thought that was a kind of interesting what. You know, we're lauding ourselves in comparative terms with China, but why don't we do better with some of our allies? I think we can be a little self-reflective ourselves. We don't want to be the 97%. The Americans are doing great, right? So in any case, I'd raise a few questions in that regard. Now, methodologically, it seems to me the two papers have somewhat different definitions of soft power. And, of course, there are many more than just two, but Bridget's, I thought was a good one. That is to say, whose model do you think's better? Of course, it leaves aside, is everybody conceiving the model as the same thing? But Minhua is essentially, do you recognize China's power, and do you think it's benign or constructive for you? So anyway, the two papers, we're coming to similar conclusions, but we're actually using different definitions of soft power to get there. So you can make what you want out of that. Let me just conclude by asking a couple of questions. One I've in effect posed, but why do we think China's what degree do we think China's foreign policy has changed? What role do we see China's neighbors playing in that change? And why do we think the Chinese seem to have difficulty processing, recognizing, and reacting constructively now to what is pretty clear messaging coming from its periphery? So I think it's sort of what drives China's foreign policy here is one set of issues. And the other thing that I guess I actually do not believe, but both papers tend to suggest, is that economic interdependence, particularly Minhua's paper, suggests economic interdependence actually works against positive perceptions. And I wonder if your measure is actually measuring interdependence or it's measuring dependence. In other words, I'd want to know who's running big trade deficits with China and is losing a lot of labor-intensive industry. And my guess is that you correct me if I'm wrong, but what you're measuring is the magnitude of the economic relationship, not the balance in the international. So another on China's to-do list, it seems to me, ought to get more balanced trade relations with its neighbors. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mike. Thank you very much, Andy. We now have 28 minutes for questions. I would ask that Bridget and Minhua fold their anything they want to say to Andy and Mike into their answers to other questions. The rules here are that wait to be recognized, and wait to be wait for the mic, identify yourself, and ask a short question. I mean, all of these people are really smart, so you don't have to do a very long and complicated question. They'll get it very briefly. So I saw a question right there. Up here in the middle, white shirt, dark tie.
Thank you very much. My name is Andrew Anderson Sprecher. And there's two data points that jumped out as interesting. I wonder if people had any comments or additional thoughts. One was with Mongolia and their negative attitudes in relation to economic interdependence. And I noticed that the trade was almost all Mongolian exports to China. So that seemed like they don't really like their customers, which goes perhaps the opposite of what Dr. Lampin said. So I thought that was something going on there. The other thing was with Philippines is nobody cited themselves as a model, and which sort of threw off the other numbers. So I was wondering if you have any thoughts on either of those data points. Thank you.
On Mongolia, I mean, one of the aspects of the economic relationship is that a lot of Chinese joint ventures in Mongolia rely on Chinese labor that they bring in, and then they create all kinds of negative social effects within Mongolian society. And so it's partly a response to that. Satu, did you have a – oh, you have a question? Okay, hang on just a second. The gentleman right there in the tan coat.
Thank you. My name is Akira Chiba from Japan, and I have a question for Dr. Huang concerning the second slide, in which he showed us the vigilance, ambivalence coordinates, so as to speak. And my question is about the southwest corner of that coordinate, because that southwest corner talked about ignoring China. Now, ignoring Japan is something not unheard of, because we pay attention to the flow, but we ignore the stock. But precisely because we pay attention to the flow, ignoring China doesn't seem to be what's really happening in this decade. So shouldn't this southwest corner be representing the affectionate low vigilance domain, in other words, what we call the panda huggers?
Okay, let's take these two. Anybody want to respond? Minhua?
It's kind of embarrassing to answer Philippines, the data question. I believe it's an execution team, probably. No? But to my knowledge, it's still very strange about no one's choose themselves. So that's I acknowledge. About Mongolia, there are a lot of, again, in China as well as in the Mongolia, I mean, they have a lot of hate feeling about China. And it's not just, it's a long history about they feel between the Russia and as well as China. And it's nationalistic feeling against China is really, really high, even economic highly dependent. And one final, which is the labeling question, I totally agree with you, is that it's not actually that sophisticated in terms of when I labeling. So it could have other interpretations too. So, yeah.
Mike, do you have?
No.
Nobody? Okay, Satu? Yeah. And then we'll go to the back.
This is really a question. Yes, thank you. Satu LeMay from the East-West Center. My question is really for the project and going forward, because you're going to do longitudinal work. What was really striking to me between the two panels and the two sets of papers is the very generally positive first set of when you didn't introduce security, but when, Bridget, you introduced geopolitics and security, the driver becomes much more negative of views of China, not on other counts as you talked about. And I wonder how you deal with that as you design the next iteration of this, because it seems that the security driver almost seems to trump every other driver. Mm-hmm. And that becomes very important if David is right, which I think is a really important point, and what Bob Setter said earlier, is that China thinks it's doing really well and doesn't need to change its foreign policy, then the security driver is likely to increase in salience to Southeast Asia.
Okay, why don't you hand the mic to Yun Han so he can respond.
I think I need to clarify a few things. Number one, that the first panel paper give you an overall picture where China stand, you know, in the public view among the Asian people. And Minghua's paper, actually, we call it the second paper as well, try to provide the kind of causal analysis, you know, what drive favorable or unfavorable view about China, okay? And then when you do the analysis, basically what you find is that, you know, if you have stronger belief in democratic value, then you tend to view China in an unfavorable light, okay? But that doesn't mean that, you know, a great majority view China in less favorable light. It's not true. But so what the, you know, the you know, what you can derive that not a great majority of Asian people strongly believe in democratic value. If they do, then China will be looked down upon, you know, in a much less favorable. But what's true is actually, you know, a lot of Asian people, you know, read our another book, you know, the How East Asia Asian View Democracy, you know, 2008, Columbia University Press. Unfortunately, in many Asian societies, East Asia, you know, not a great majority, they are strongly committed to liberal democratic value. Okay, so that's why they can continue to view China in a very favorable light, you know, in terms of absolute level. So that's why, you know, the two papers actually, you know, they're compatible. Mm-hmm. So if you look at, you know, the other side, you know, causal mechanism, then you'll say, oh, you know, China has a lot of problems, you know, if they don't reform their political system, if they don't be nice to a neighbor, and so on and so forth, okay? But at the same time, you might argue the other way around, that is to say, despite of the security concern, despite of geographical consideration, China's influence on the region is still, relatively speaking, you know, more positive view than otherwise, okay? So the damage has been limited, and it's not as bad as it is, okay? Although that remains one of the very important explanatory sources for the difference. I don't know whether I clarify that.
Okay. Mike?
Two things. One, the continual observation that security is the big negative, if not the big one, a very big one. Of course, this fits with, I guess we'll call it group and social psychology, Maslow, the hierarchy of human needs. I mean, security's the first thing on every group and individual, and then economics, and then self-actualization. So I think the findings fit with what we know about group and indeed individual nation behavior. Just one other thing, though, on this democratic values, and it's clearly, I think these papers indicate the importance of that as a variable, and I accept it, and I thought the comments Andy made were great. But if you're trying to think from a policy point of view, so what does China do with that information? Go democratic tomorrow, not an option, right? But if it had a credible plan to move in a more liberal, let us say, direction, you could get some play there. I mean, part of it is the perception that China may be not going in the right direction. So you have the capacity to, I think you have the capacity to get going in a better direction, right? So it's not a bimodal. You're either that or you're not that, and you're locked in. So, you know, I think China has the capacity. I don't mean that it will do it. I'm not predicting it will. But it has the theoretic option of going through a period of tutelage and to a more bright democratic future in some more distant. I think there's an option there.
Oh. It's an interesting way of putting it. Yu Donghui in the back, and then I'll come to the middle.
Thank you. Donghui Yu with China Review News Agency. Talking about the soft power, China's First Lady Peng Liyuan is making her international debut. It's sparking the faction frenzy in China. The Western media generally had a positive reporting about her performance. What do you think about her debut? Do you think it's a kind of special soft power that Chinese government could take advantage to promote its image in the international arena? Thank you.
Does anybody want to touch that one?
As the only woman on the panel, I will point out that the data shows that men choose China as a model more than women, so maybe there's more room to reach out to women.
Mm-hmm. I want to mention, you know, from the question that I raised about different theories that shape how messages are received, how, you know, they might be shaped through the media and stuff like that. This brings up an interesting question about how the sort of pre-existing evaluative frame of the receiver affects the message. So one message can be sent out and it can mean very different things to different people. And one of the things that struck me was some commentary that I saw around that when she put on national minority costumes and sang national minority songs, certain Americans received that as very, very negative because we have a completely different history of race relations in this country and a different perspective on race. So we would think, how can the dominant race don the costume and appropriate the music of an oppressed race? This is a form of oppression. But I recognize that that vision of what she did is extremely shaped by a unique American, you know, receiving framework. And so I think it, the example, this is not to, quite an answer to your question, but it is to point out a theoretical issue that attends all of this kind of research.
Michael Yehuda in the middle right here.
Thank you very much. Given that geopolitics seems to be one of the themes that has come up, I wonder if there's one aspect of it that deserves more attention. And that is, we're dealing with a country which is perceived as very great, surrounded by smaller countries. And if we look at similar situations, I think if we look at India, I don't think we would find that its neighbors feel very pleased to be next door to India. If we look at Russia, I don't think its neighbors feel very pleased to be next to Russia. And I think even in the United States, you would find
especially
that
in
Canadians
the
and the Mexicans don't dance with delight every day to say how wonderful their neighbor is. And I think this may be also a factor with regard to China and its neighborhood. And, of course, China has its own characteristics that may make its relationship with its neighbors even more difficult. But again, one of the characteristics of great countries like this is that they're very absorbed in themselves. They pay very little attention to what are the cultures and interests of their neighbors. And I think that creates difficulties when the great country seeks somehow or other to reach across to them in some forms of propaganda or whatever term one wants to use. But I think this sort of great power problem needs to be brought in if one is going to talk about geopolitics.
Anybody? Bridget?
I think I want to pick up a little bit on what you've said and speak a little bit to what Mike said earlier. I think, you know, there is a lot of unpacking that needs to be done in terms of vis-a-vis the questions of neighbors. And you talk about it in terms of culture and position, which I think is a very right way. But I also think when we look at the economic interdependence variable, this is something I struggled with, right? Because you have a lot of investment by China in its neighbors in environmentally not so sound areas, for example, in Myanmar and in Cambodia. And so it's not just about jobs. It's also about the nature of these types of investment, right, which goes back to what you're saying, the nature of the relationship, which has to be looked at in a much more, I think, unpacked way. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the reason the economic interdependence variable did not come up as significant is because I think we haven't unpacked it yet. And we have to unpack these things with a bit more nuance for us to understand what is the type of dynamic. And also, you know, for example, in Myanmar, they look at the Chinese as big brother, but at the same time, there's these cultural types of antagonisms that also exist. These things also have to be tried to be captured, I think, as the survey moves forward, not just looking at drivers of security, but also looking at drivers of cultural interrelationships and much more careful attention to how they perceive the economic ties.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to, Mike?
I just wanted to respond to Michael's very good observation, and we sometimes just forget the obvious, that big powers have littler neighbors, and that sets up a whole set of generic problems. I agree. But China has behaved more and less over time, reassuringly to its neighbors. If you look, and what I have in mind when I say that is look at the solution, resolution of almost all its land borders. We got a still problem with India and so on. I don't mean all. But basically, I remember studying it appeared in China Quarterly that basically said, you know, the Chinese resolved, in terms of measured by square miles, the non-Chinese claimant to the border got it resolved in a way that was relatively favorable to them. So it still leaves the question, why can't China adopt a similar approach in dealing with its maritime claims that are causing it so much difficulty? So, yes, I think big powers always have problems with their littler neighbors or less influential in some way. But there still has been variation in Chinese behavior over time. It has behaved in ways that are much more reassuring and less reassuring. I mean, just look at the Taiwan Straits and what the Chinese approach there is, I think, is fairly sensible. So, your observation justified but doesn't, in my mind, do away with the problem.
I mean, and just to extend the point, the history of the United States in the Western Hemisphere also has the dimension of multiple interventions in Mexico and Central America and Cuba and Santo Domingo, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And is that the direction that China's going? I hope not. We didn't gain any points from doing it here. The gentleman right here.
Thank you. My name is Kenley from Chinese Embassy. I think two comments, brief. One is this study all mentioned that it seems China have to be nice to its neighbors. The underlying assumption is its neighbors is nice, and China is a bad guy. All neighbors is a good guy. I think we have to... I mean, objectively, look why China, actually sometimes China is reaction to its neighbors. So when look at these things, you have to also judge about the neighbor's policy. That's one comment.
Mm-hmm.
The second comment is we can also ask this question in terms of values or economic or political development. And I think the question is, if we ask, is China more open now than 10 years ago? So why? I mean, China actually, at least itself believes that the Chinese political reform has made a big progress. But it seems that the progress is not recognized. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody want to comment? He reinforced a point that you had made.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions? The gentleman right back there in the tan sweater.
Hello. My name is Antoine Roth. I'm a student at George Washington University. And my question comes back to security. And so, into what extent do you think the change in distribution of power, considering really in terms of basic military forces and the actual the math of it, how does it influence perception, and how does China mitigate that? Professor Lambton mentioned this successful reassurance campaign, so just what's the effect on perceptions in the neighborhood? Thank you.
Any takers? Yes, Mike?
I guess I've sort of come to a view, and it may not be correct, but I see China, I think back to Science and Civilization on China by Joseph Needham.
Why are you pointing at me?
Because in case I forgot the name, you were going to rescue
me. Yeah, because I'm as old as Needham.
But anyway, the idea that China, Chinese people, China sees itself in a network of relationships and not in a network of absolute rules and so forth. So as power changes, all of the relationships in this network have to adjust. And so in my view, it's self-evident, economic and military power of China is going up. China in the preceding period, whether it was 100 years or the last 50 or the last 30, had to negotiate a set of relations, whether it was with respect to Taiwan or with respect to the Philippines or the South China Sea. And generally speaking, those were not entirely satisfactory implicit negotiations for the China. They accepted less than they wanted. Now, China's power is growing, and it thinks it's entitled to negotiate better deals. I think that's the underlying dynamic. There isn't an absolute set of rules here. There's an ever-negotiating set of networks. And as your power changes, the weak are not entitled to as much as the strong. I think that's the world we're in.
Anybody else? Any other questions? Okay, what I would propose is to thank our panelists, and we'll conclude this session and move immediately to the next one. So Andy Nathan stays up at the table. I stay up here. Jonathan comes up, and Yun Han will chair.
Here is the wrap-up session. As we announced and promised, you know, in the beginning of the program. I know that, you know, this is Good Friday, and we're approaching noontime. So we have a lot of enemy. But at the same time, I'm sure that, you know, you're all anxious to listen to our three panelists. They will each give a 10-minute lead-off remark. And then, you know, we will come back to the floor, you know, then we can attend more Q&A, during the remaining 20 to 30 minutes. Obviously, here we are at Brookings, and we want to extract as much, not just intellectual juices out of those data, but also what's the implication for the region, for U.S. policy toward East Asia, especially as the Obama administration entering its second term, and many important positions, you know, at the policy-making level will to be filled pretty soon. I think, you know, obviously we want to listen to the three wise men, you know, what kind of advice they can give to the second term Obama administration. So, Jonathan, should I invite you to speak first?
No particular order, but we can certainly go that way. I'm trying to reflect first on some of what I think I've learned today. Many years ago, a very, very famous political scientist, Arnold Wolfers, talked about national security as an ambiguous concept, and I think maybe public opinion is also an ambiguous concept. I mean, I've been enlightened about the sheer complexity of this phenomenon, and indeed the way it may operate in various Asian states often may be counterintuitive. But it's a reminder that political behavior is not all elite behavior. The intensity of beliefs, the malleability of beliefs, it still seems to me is an open question. In this regard, I think also several of the points made by different commentators stick out in my own mind, that, you know, implicitly, I think, a lot of the arguments made today reflected the presumption of economics as a factor that has influenced perceptions of China up to a point. And what strikes me is that perhaps many of China's neighbors wish China stability and success, but maybe not too much success. But given the sheer weight of the Chinese economy, given the fact that often China has money to throw around, if you will, may change that calculation. In this respect, thinking about soft power and the notion of China and the United States being in a soft power competition, I think is problematic, because American soft power emerges out of a whole host of factors and attractions in the way who we are and how we go about it. I dare say that China's model of soft power is kind of, if I could mix my metaphors, sort of a brute force model of soft power, in the sense that China does have lots of money, and sometimes you do throw money at a problem, but it doesn't really have that kind of organic quality, it seems to me. But in this respect, perhaps the calculation in China is that in the same way that China domestically gets this resounding support from its own citizens, remarkable numbers, perhaps the presumption is that the same principle could apply in how China tries to influence thinking beyond its borders. Here, I agree very, very strongly with Michael Yehuda's point about just simply the reminder of the sheer magnitude and self-absorption that big states have. Little states can be very self-absorbed, too. It's just simply that the consequences of being big make that calculation very, very different. One thing that I would like to highlight, however, and here I agree very much to a point made by Mike Lampton, is that I don't know. I mean, we can be very fatalistic about this. You know, this is always the way Chinese have behaved. It's never going to change, never, never, never. When, in fact, I don't think we're dealing with static considerations, nor are we dealing with a world of simply either or. I'm kind of on the warpath on this. I think we tend to get so trapped in binary thinking when the world that I understand is a world of more or less, or it's something in between. The question is whether or not that kind of a perception can materialize and see an evolution of the Chinese system over time such that its influence would be more by indirection rather than by sheer dominance. I don't know that we're at that point. In fact, I don't think we are at that point. I think that when we ask ourselves either the attraction or the aversion to China, it will be very, very much a function of the kind of Chinese system we are dealing with and how it behaves. Now, in this regard, rather than Americans being a little too smug about their power, let's remember that the development of China and the more favorable views of China that emerged so much from the late 90s onwards were in part a direct consequence of America's rather unappealing behavior abroad. If we've gotten smarter about it, so much the better, although there are no guarantees. I mean, I find it kind of ironic that at least in terms of the operative dominant characterization that Chinese the party and the propaganda apparatus make about the United States, it almost describes the United States as much more heavy-handed today than it was in the Bush administration, and I dare say that in my own view that there's a problem there with the facts and with cause and effect. One other point I would want to make, and I think it bears on all of our discussions here today, and that is the perceived salience of security as a factor. As China becomes more powerful, how does it choose to exercise that power? Because it does seem to me, as China has the means to assert its influence both directly and indirectly, it may well be that some of these more positive perceptions of China on the part of neighbors will erode significantly in the years to come. One last point I'd want to make just as we try to characterize China. I'm struck by so much of the work that Ian Johnston has done to look at variations in public opinion within the Chinese system. In essence, finding a kind of a cosmopolitan quality in the Beijing area survey of findings again and again and again, where you have more educated individuals, more worldly, and so forth and so on. And that leads, not unsurprisingly, to very, very different attitudes about the outside world. So by that, I think we really have to ask ourselves some questions about what kind of an identity does China assume, what degree of tolerance or lack of tolerance will there be for variations within the system as China gets to be, in some respects, an even more messier system in the future. Does that lead to a more relaxed or more anxious view of China? When I said before that neighbors don't want China to be too successful, at the same time, I think that there are acute anxieties about instability in China and what some of its consequences might be. So I think that the papers here today have and the richness of the discussion gives us not only a lot of food for thought, but I think it has really enriched our debate, or ought to enrich our debate and our understanding of China and how outside actors try to influence Chinese behavior over the longer term. Thank you.
Now we'll turn to Richard Bush.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Yunhan. I tried to put myself in the shoes of an American policymaker whom Yunhan came to brief about the results of this survey and think, how would I react? Now, I should say I'm decidedly not a policymaker. This is just a mental exercise. But I would have a variety of reactions. In general, I would first of all be really excited to have real data. Too often we are instructed by governments or by pundits on what the opinions are of Asian publics and how we should take their definition of public opinion into account. Well, this is a good corrective. Second, I would be happy that the United States is doing better than I probably would have expected. The last decade, frankly, was really mixed for the U.S. image. And based on some of these findings, we're not doing so bad. The U.S. model is still attractive in some places compared to China. Interdependence is a double-edged sword because it creates losers as well as winners. We do benefit sometimes from China's actions. And I would find it a little bit ironic that China is using culture to promote its power and influence when the Chinese Communist Party is probably the one organization that's done the most to destroy and degrade and otherwise harm traditional Chinese culture. My final general comment would be that rebalancing didn't come too late. Maybe just soon enough, but it didn't come too late. Certainly we need to implement it well. We have to recognize that based on some of Minhua's findings, we are still going ahead, going against the tide of East Asian expectations. that China's going up, it's going to be more influential over the next decade, and the United States will not. I think that I would also recognize that the future of the U.S. Around the world and in East Asia is in our hands. And we need to rebuild the pillars of our national power if we're going to be able to have the kind of role that we want to have, and which I think East Asians want us to play because it gives them more flexibility. My second general reaction in response to these results would be to be very hungry for more. I mean, it's very important that these surveys are continued so that we see what the trends are over time. I think that problem of any survey research is that sometimes the findings are a function of the questions, and general questions in particular allow the respondent to interpret what the concepts mean. If you say, "What do you think of the Chinese model?" Well, different people are going to have different understandings of what that means. And sometimes responses are a function of knowledge, and Yunhan understands that very well. I think that we can take an example from one of the papers in the first panel that it would be useful for me as a policymaker to know what my citizenry thought about two questions that were more specific than the ones that are asked. And number one is, do you think that China will challenge the U.S. position and role in East Asia in the next 10 years? What Americans think about that, I think, is important. Number two, is our economic relationship with China yielding mutual benefit? I know what the President of the United States thinks on that question, and his answer is no. And his answer counts a little bit more. But it would be good to know what the public thinks. On a methodological note, it would be very interesting for me to know how entrenched are the opinions that these surveys yield. To what extent are they a function of events that occurred in the weeks and months right before the poll was taken? Or are we sort of identifying things that are rather more fundamental and which are not going to be changed? I mean, if it's a function of recent events, and if we assume that China is going to be more assertive, then that may increase negative views in East Asia. And it may create opportunities for U.S. policy to exploit to promote our own interests. Rebalancing, I think, can be seen in this light. We're not about to contain China, but it does allow us and our friends in the region to strengthen their hedge as they deal with China. I think the most profound message that I would take away from this data is that leaders matter. Leaders matter. Note that their job is embedded in the label we put on them. The job of leaders is to lead, not to be led around. Now, leaders have to sort of take account of public opinion and all kinds of other things. But I think too often in recent years we've seen Asian leaders be led rather than lead. Look again at U.S. opinion about China. By and large, the findings that you got were sensible. I'm not surprised that Americans think that. I also think that those views are not frozen. Therefore, that creates an opportunity for the President of the United States, should he or she choose to use it, to shape support for whatever policy he or she wishes to pursue. Looking at China, I and looking at this result that Chinese people think that they're doing just fine, thank you. I think Chinese leaders, as part of their responsibility to lead, is to talk some sense to the Chinese public and be honest with them about the consequences of China's action. I know this is hard to do, there's some institutional obstacles to doing so, but I think that we would all be better off, and Chinese leaders would be better off with a certain amount of honesty. I think leaders do have, if they're skillful, the ability to define as a country's interests in certain ways rather than let others define the interest. They're able to define what the relevant public is and not let others do it for them. And in this situation, leaders have a couple of different options. They can act like demagogues, and they can create opinion that sort of inflicts on themselves a certain set of policies. And there's always enough material to demagogue a foreign policy issue. Leaders can worry too much about the feelings of the 1.3 billion Chinese people. And if you're a weak state in Southeast Asia, then maybe you have a certain temptation to do it. But, you know, sometimes it's useful to draw a line. So I think Singapore is a good example here. Finally, another option is to do a good job in justifying the mixed strategy that most countries pursue towards China, and China's pursuing a mixed strategy towards us. Now, all of this is easy for me to say, that leaders should lead, and I understand that our president and every other leader in East Asia is in a very complicated situation. I think that this would be easier to do if leaders interact with each other more and develop between themselves a deeper understanding of each other's situation. They, after all, are the only ones in their country who have the broadest vision of their country's interest. They are the only ones at the top of their systems who can task various agencies, each of which has their own interests, to act more in terms of the leader's interest rather than their own. Thank you very much.
Andy? Thank you. Well, we know that governments do invest in soft power, in public diplomacy, and they do so in different ways, as Bob Sutter pointed out. I guess the Chinese soft power strategy has been much more government-led and is more consistent on message, and the American soft power strategy, which has been around for quite a long time, has depended a lot on funding, you know, jazz musicians to go overseas, for example, in the 50s, and more people-to-people kinds of things, and bringing visitors to this country from other countries. The Japanese government has invested a lot in the international promotion of anime, which I would have, to me, makes a bad image, but to the apparently to the teen, and the Korean government, I guess, has invested in promoting K-pop and so forth. And so there are different styles, and the Chinese style is one. And I would like to raise the question of why do governments care about soft power and put some money into it? And I guess that is different for countries that have different international issues and different international strategies. So that, for example, I guess the U.S. has been investing in soft power over the years with a national, I'm just guessing, I mean, I'm not asserting that this is the case, but with a national strategy of really trying to change the values of other countries in the world to be more compatible with the American political system and economic system to promote liberal capitalism and some concept, which maybe is a crazy concept, that if the world were more like the United States, American security would be enhanced by that. I don't think Chinese soft power strategy is at all, in my opinion, and I think the papers agree with this, is at all directed toward a security strategy that if all the governments in the world were like China, then China would be more secure. I think another – so that's a difference. I think that both American and Chinese soft power strategy is directed at opening markets, at making it just better to land in some airport someplace and be an American or be a Chinese and be understood and be trusted to some extent and have an easier time, just getting down to business. And that's a reason why both China and the United States have brought a lot of students from other parts of the world to their educational institutions so that they can learn the language and be cooperators when they go back home to their own country with people coming from the mother country, as it were. Now, I think another purpose of Chinese soft strategy, and especially in Asia during the time that they pursued this theory of peaceful rise, was to was this assurance strategy that Mike Lampton alluded to of sort of reducing, diminishing the degree to which the Asian countries would bandwagon, would balance against China by bandwagoning with the United States, just to reduce the tendency to be afraid of China so that countries would not consider, say, they would be happy to cooperate with China's economic rise and happy to welcome China into the ASEAN plus three framework and things like that, not fearing Chinese intentions. So that reassurance strategy, that was a purpose of it, I think. And I'm not sure, and perhaps that also is a reason for the Americans. If you compare those to somebody like Japan or South Korea, I think their soft power strategies have been predominantly commercial in purpose. Then it raises the question of, is it worth it? You know, so is soft power worth spending money on? Does it matter to serve national security goals? Now, I tend to be convinced by Bob Sutter and Satu's, and I guess everybody I think has alluded to this, that when it comes to pursuing one's foreign policy interests, it's the elites who usually make policy and whose attitude toward you is more important than the mass. Now, here we have what's valuable about these studies, and not completely unique but relatively innovative about these studies, is that they look at the mass. They look at public opinion, at mass public opinion. And this raises the question of, do we care as policymakers, as American or Chinese policymakers? Yunhan said, let the average person speak through these surveys, but do we care as policymakers what they think? That raises the question of, what is the influence of public opinion on foreign policy? And that varies a great deal. It varies by the country type, the political system type. So in a democratic system like the United States, public opinion has more influence. In China, I would say less. It varies by the policy area. So in the, say, trade area in the U.S., trade policy is quite influenced by, as Satu was saying, by the interests of each congressional district, and something like security policy is less influenced because the public knows less, cares less, sees less, unless you're losing a war someplace and the public wants to get out. And it depends on the strategic space that a country has. So a country like Vietnam or like most Southeast Asian countries has very little choice, actually, about what to do in their foreign policy. And so it doesn't matter what the public thinks. The elites have to do what they have to do. So particularly when it comes to our subject here of that we've mainly concentrated on is Chinese behavior influencing the publics in Asia in a way that would influence Chinese interests in Asia? I'm a little skeptical about that. Whether the Chinese publics like China or whether the Asian publics in country A, B, C, or D like China or don't like China, I'm not sure that it makes much difference to the policies that the foreign policy makers in those Asian countries find themselves basically constrained to adopt by reality. And here I sort of disagree with a point that appeared in in one of the papers that Yunhan co-authored, in which you said that the Asian countries are not balancing against China. I mean, if the Japan alliance with the U.S. and Korean alliance and Philippine alliance and Vietnamese quasi-alliance and so forth with the United States aren't balancing against China, then I don't know what balancing against China would look like. And I think these countries are simply doing what they have to do on the chessboard of politics, regardless of what the public thinks. And this would bring me to my final question, which converges a lot with Mike Lampton's remark at the end of the last panel, which is, we want China to be nice, but if you're a Chinese policymaker, is it really worth it to be nice? I would say perhaps not. In fact, it's often very beneficial in international affairs to be not nice. And I think this is the moment that the Chinese strategists think it's probably time for us to really take off the gloves and, you know, show that we're tough. If other people are afraid of us, that's good. That's better. Because we need to, we cannot tolerate the current balance of power in Asia. We've got to move the ball sometime. And this is the time. The Americans are weak. They're tied up. They can't even tie their shoelaces, you know, and they talk a lot, but they're going no place. The Japanese have temporarily elected another prime minister who will last for 6 or 7 months who talks tough, but he's out, you know. And this is a really great time for us to be tough. And the other guys are going to bitch and moan, and then they're going to back off. So if you don't like it, that's okay. It's a good enough trade-off.
Wow. Andrew Nathan always surprises us. We can still entertain a few questions if you have any burning questions. Yeah, the gentleman way in the back. Yeah. Would you please identify yourself and also keep your question short? Yeah.
I'm Pat Malloy. I'm a trade lawyer, and I teach at Catholic University Law School as an adjunct trade professor. I've been concerned about the imbalance in the economic relationship between the United States and China. I thought Richard Bush really hit it when he pointed out that I've always thought the economic imbalance will poison the political relationship in time, because even though the elites may feel, as Professor Nathan said, they form foreign policy, even though they may favor a closer relationship, most Americans don't think that we're benefiting from this relationship, and in fact that it's harming the country. And so I just wanted to throw that out and say, what do the panel think about that observation?
I would suggest actually, I can collect a few questions and then come back to the panel for them to have their last word. Any other? Yes. Right here, yeah.
Eric McVaden, the Institute for Foreign Policy Analysis. The African-American and Latino components of our society are growing very significantly in size. It's my impression that those two components have very little interest in knowledge, maybe for understandable reasons, of our foreign policy and our relations with Asia, maybe Europe, the Middle East, and so forth. Do you think that's true, and does it matter?
Jeffrey Lim, Senator Angus Kane's office.
I was wondering in particular, given that there's a whole bunch of territorial disputes brewing in Asia without any Chinese involvement, if China might be sort of tempted to eventually start picking sides in said disputes, like, for example, the what happened recently in Malaysia with those followers of the Sultan coming down into Sabah province, for example, that China could try to, or at least try to play a mediator role, perhaps to improve its image in Asia, use it as sort of leverage to balance out the recent events of the past 2 years.
Okay, yes. Two more gentlemen in yellow tie, yes.
Michael, you
heard. Oh, Mike,
from,
yeah.
From
sorry.
GW. My question is for Andy Nathan. The picture of China you presented to us was that it's now the tough guy. The international context favors that position for China. But on the other hand, the Chinese government is spending a lot of money in trying to improve its image in the outside world. In addition to which, the Chinese government does seem sensitive to certain kinds of human rights issues. For example, there was the blind activist, and they rather than standing up to the Americans and saying you're interfering in our affairs, buzz off, on the contrary, they acted in many ways that would seem unexpected given the presentation you've given. And as you said earlier on, a lot of your work is concerned with human rights issues in China. So do you feel that the outside world can have some influence in the way human rights may develop in China? Or do you think that we've reached, as it were, in the cycle of developments, a very bad period for the capacity of outsiders to change human rights in China for the better?
Thank you. Li Yangdong from Zhejiang University. Andrew actually depicted a very interesting picture about aggressive action, possibly aggressive action from China. And Richard expressed the concern that probably over the next decade that U.S. control over the entire Asian area most probably will be undermined by the rapid rise of China. Well, given all those concerns, I'm very curious about what will be the actions or reactions from U.S. side for the foreign policy in this area.
Okay. Okay. One last question. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you very much for taking so many factors into consideration. I'm Beverly Hong Fincher. Anyway, but I find one important feature that is missing in all these surveys, that is the overseas Chinese, and they are just omnipresent in all these, you know, Southeast Asia, Taiwan, you know, U.S., for example. And, you know, and we talk it in the U.S., and in the last election, everybody talks about, you know, African Americans, you know, Latino Americans, but nobody talks about Asian Americans, very few anyway. But they all vote in a certain way. But as you know, I mean, that opinion is very, very important. And I wonder why you did not take the diasporic Chinese into consideration in your surveys. Thank you.
Okay. Before I go back to our panelists, maybe I should answer that specific question. Well, actually, we collect data on people's ethnicity. So when we do survey in Singapore, you know, we know whether, you know, the respondents are Malay, India, or Chinese, and same thing in Malaysia, and things like that. So, but I think this variable might be important in a country like Singapore and Malaysia, but in Indonesia, the proportion to the population too small. Okay, so we cannot do any kind of meaningful analysis. Same thing can say about Thailand and Thai. Sometimes they don't want to review, you know, a lot of people are, say, a quarter Chinese or, So that's another variable that can be applied, you know, across the board. That's why it has not be shown here. But we do intend to do more country-specific analysis. And this variable will definitely be incorporated into our model, you know, whenever they are relevant. So thank you for your comment.
And that's true for the U.S. sample, too. There aren't enough.
Not enough. Chinese, not enough.
Hispanic Americans. That's right. No. To do that analysis.
That's right. Yeah.
You just need to get more funding to do.
Or you should do a more targeted, interview. Anyway, so I will start with Andy in that order, and then Jonathan, you can have the last word.
So, first of all, to answer Michael's question, on the case of the blind activist Chen Guangcheng, there were some unique circumstances. He was in the American embassy, which made it very difficult to find a way to deal with him without the agreement of the Americans. And it was on the eve of what important meeting was it? The strategic dialogue?
SNED.
The strategic and economic dialogue, which where there are a lot of equities, you know, and you didn't want to, the Chinese side had a huge incentive to settle the question quickly, but since he, and so they reached an agreement that I agree was extraordinarily, it was unique in its generosity. I mean, and that uniqueness is important because there's never been another thing later or since or before. There's never been such a case. And so I don't think it reflects a real change in Chinese policy. And when you consider how their promises to him were kept, then you see that they weren't. In other words, the mistreatment that he had received was not investigated, although they had committed to do so. His relatives back in the village in Dongshugu have continued to be abused and so on. But to answer your broader question, I don't think, I'm not too optimistic about pressure from the outside world having a major impact on Chinese government policies that the outside world is pressing them about. What I think has more of an impact is the indirect influence of encouragement and assistance and various forms of ways in which the outside factor strengthens the inside factors that are at work, which are very slow moving and unpredictable. So I think it's the outside pieces is essential, but that its weight as a cause of change is relatively small. On the, I just want to correct the word that you used when you said that I said that China was taking aggressive action. I always avoid that word because I think aggressive action would be something like China's having an ever-expanding set of territorial claims or something like that, something expansionist. And I think that the Chinese territorial claims are quite stable. They've been there for a long time. They're just as good as anybody else's territorial claims, which is to say not that good. But, I mean, you know, these territorial claims are all very, open to debate. And so I would like the word, which I think most China specialists use, of assertive. China is asserting its claims, and those claims are stable, and they're, you know, not unreasonable from an international law point of view, not that they're necessarily correct. But your question is then how will – but that does represent a change, I think, in Chinese policy and one to which the U.S. is responding with this rebalancing. And I think the U.S. policy under Obama has been and will continue to be, even though he has different secretaries of state and defense, will continue to be a kind of pushback, and that the two countries are trying to find out where their interests overlap and to find some kind of, you know, I like the word rebalancing, to find some balance. And that will produce friction, and I hope not kinetic conflict. And I won't answer the other questions because they were directed at the others, but I want to underscore this question, because you said that you know that the president thinks that U.S.-China economic relations are not mutually beneficial, and I wondered how, where has he said that? How do we know that? And that's kind of amazing.
I know from people who have worked for him that he feels strongly about this. During the campaign, he made the remark more than once that he said China does not play by the rules.
Mm-hmm.
In the context of American society and culture, where from a very young age kids are taught to play by the rules, this is a strong statement.
I see.
And I think it does, in fact, reflect his deep-seated views.
So are you over?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Take Pat's question first, which I've already started to answer. And it's on this question of mutual benefit. Now, first I would say that there was a deliberate decision early on for the United States to be prepared to give China a certain advantage when it came to access to the U.S. market, to U.S. technology, to U.S. higher education, and so on. And this was part of a larger strategic purpose, and that was to incorporate China into the international system, to domesticate it, if you will, and so that its revival as a great power would not be destabilizing. And I think that remains the policy to this day. We have made adjustments all the way along, and we've had to deal with new contexts, but I think that's the basic approach. I would say that the degree of mutual benefit depends very much on which part of the country you're talking about and which sectors you were talking about. Obviously, some sectors continue to derive great benefit from China. Think of the Pacific Northwest. Think of California. On balance, they've done pretty well over time. But there are other parts of the country, and we know what they are, that have whose fortunes have declined as our economic relationship with China has grown. Now, there is the question of you know, does one cause the other? Globalization has certainly led to a decline in standard of living for a large segment of Americans. Economists might say that technological change is just as important a factor in this development as globalization is, and that whatever we do vis-a-vis China, we have to address within our own system the need to create the human resources that can cope with a context of rapid technological change. And that's one of the pillars of national power that our leaders have a responsibility to rebuild. I agree with you that in the past, elites, particularly economic elites, were in favor of this incorporative economic policy towards China. I worked on Capitol Hill for a while, and the members that I worked for relied on those economic elites to do what they wanted to do. So I know how that game is played. But I think we're in a new situation now where increasingly those very economic elites who have participated, who have supported longstanding U.S. economic policy towards China, are changing their mind. And that's primarily because of the cybersecurity issue, and they feel they're getting ripped off, that China is pursuing economic growth through theft. There are also concerns about the changing business environment in China. And this trend, if it continues, is not good for China because of the support that the business community has provided for a certain approach to U.S.-China relations. So I think, actually, President Obama has positioned himself in what turns out to be a really good point on the spectrum. To come to your question. I agree with you, particularly on the word assertive rather than aggressive. I would say that what is somewhat new in this situation is that China has changed the way it is asserting its territorial claims, however much merit they have. And in fact, it is acting in ways that seek incrementally to change the status quo. And that's something the United States opposes. Now, looking at the broad picture, I really hope that the United States and China, through their interaction, can create for the long term a relationship of coexistence in East Asia. I think we will have to face a series of test cases within the region and outside. North Korea is the toughest one right now. Taiwan was tough. It could get tough again. Maritime Asia is another set. And our two countries together are going to have to work very, very hard day by day and week by week to ensure that we handle these issues well, in part because third countries are very important to the outcomes. I would, though, say that China's leaders themselves say we still need a peaceful international environment to deal with the array of domestic challenges. We want a new pattern of great power relations so that we don't repeat dynamics that created World War I, World War II, the Cold War, and so on. And that's not a bad thing.
Jonathan?
Well, I don't want to take too much time to stand between the audience, that many of whom have stayed, and your lunch. But I am struck that in our concluding panel, of course, by design, we have tried to raise some of the larger issues, moving away from some of the considerations that are factor in these papers. And yet, I do think that there are so many interconnections here that, on the one hand, we are talking about a society and a system that in some respects, in terms of its international role and activities, is just simply not recognizable with what it was several decades ago. This is an ongoing process. I think that considered at the level of what the United States tries to achieve with China, what messages it tries to send, will in some measure have an influence on future Chinese behavior. Richard just alluded to the whole question of a new framework for major power relations, which to American ears, at least mine, seems pretty content-free. It really reflects a very, very different kind of operative style. The Chinese are always trying to define some kind of a set of principles and apply them until they no longer apply. So, you know, ironically, if I think about it, peaceful rise doesn't look very peaceful right now. So you're trying to sort of up the ante to see if you can actually evolve some sort of rules of the road with the United States. But then again, Americans tend to approach things in very, very operational fashion. Here's a problem. Here's an issue. What are we going to do about it? And what, regardless of the frustrations with China, I think that there is a broad recognition. It has been there, I think, through not virtually every American presidential administration that has dealt with China, that your real choices look very, very different when you're sitting in the White House. That doesn't mean that we are craven and simply yield to China all the time, but the realities of the interconnections between the United States and China make it extremely difficult to apply, if you will, the starker kinds of characterizations of what we might do. This is true across the board, including on economic relations, which I'm glad that was raised. Even that is a very, very complicated picture. Now, and it's true, there is a fierce objection now that I think Obama does feel to the idea that that although I don't think he's ever used the word cheat, but that's the implication, that there is... You don't play by the rules. You know, you got a thumb on the scale. You're stealing not only technology, but more to the point, you're penetrating into the cyber world in all kinds of ways that I don't have a remote clue to understand. But in a way, it kind of highlights, it seems to me, the fundamental tension in our relationship with China. In an ironic way, what America really does want is a very authoritative, powerful Chinese state with real central authority that can presumably crack down on miscreants of one kind or another, make sure that intellectual property rights are policed and so forth and so on, rather than even though sometimes our debate about these issues may ignore these considerations, we don't want a weak China, but we want a, you know, to use Zelig's word, we want a responsible China, whatever we may think that is. But our definition of responsibility may be changing over time as China changes over time. The other thing that I think I would want to highlight is we necessarily tend to singularize the relationship with China, and yet the panel today, the presentations today, ought to be a reminder to us that the relationship with China is not simply a big power game. There are a whole range of states, obviously all of China's neighbors, that are profoundly affected not only by China's evolution over time, but by the character of the relationship and policies that the United States enunciates vis-a-vis China. That will remain a work very, very much in progress. A couple of other points I'd want to make when we ask about China and when we ask about how we influence China. I'm always thinking about, I forget the precise numbers, Richard, you may have these at the tip of your fingers, or that the extent of the American presence in China and how it is perceived. And by presence, I mean presence of all kinds, students, business, governmental, NGOs, what have you. This is where to other powers, and I think here of both China and of Russia, you know, the United States is often looked upon as intrusive, annoying, demanding, hectoring, and yet I think at some level, probably a lot of Chinese are quietly rooting for the United States to persist with some of what it does. But I think here again, we have to proceed in realistic fashion. I know that can be very, very frustrating particularly when we see Chinese behavior that violates our sensibilities and what clearly are global norms. I'm struck, for example, by the disclosures from the study on cybersecurity and the protestations of Chinese innocence that come from on high. And my reaction to that is, if it is truly the case that the Chinese government, we'll use that label, does not know, that is uninvolved in what goes on in that 10-story building in Shanghai, then there's been a rather, then someone's asleep at the switch in China. Coming back yet again to what kind of a China do we want? In all of this, I think I always come back to the fact that fundamentally, these are issues of China's domestic evolution in ways large and small, the latitude that its citizens have or do not have for pursuing their own interests and so forth, and how this manifests itself in terms of China's inescapable weight in Asia as a whole. And I think that there's a lot more work that has to be done here, but I am very glad that we have introduced these factors that often do not intrude upon all the grand conceptualizations and strategies that people talk about vis-a-vis China. These are people involved more than anything else, and societies involved, and we ought to bear that in mind. To all of you, I thank you for your your attention and interest. This has been a very, very lively afternoon. And on behalf of the Thornton Center, let me thank again all of our contributors today. It's really been great fun to be here today, and we hope we have other opportunities. Richard.
I share those sentiments. I thank the audience for your questions. I apologize for the air conditioning. I can't wait to get out of here. But before we do, I'd like to echo Jonathan's earlier comment and thank you and Han for giving us the opportunity to do this program. It was at your initiative that we learned about this set of studies in the first place, and I think it's been a very rich discussion. We are indebted to you. Thanks.
Now, we finally come to the end, but before we break up, I just want to thank Jonathan and Richard once more time for organizing this event and also their wonderful staff working behind the curtain. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you all.